physics had another earthquake in 1982. And this quantum reality, this book, was written in 1986. Now we just read this single sentence from it.
Bell's theorem shows that although the world's phenomena seem strictly local, the reality beneath this phenomenal surface must be beyond the speed of light. The world's deep reality is maintained by invisible quantum connections whose alternating interval is unmediated, unmitigated, and immediate.
It's just worth knowing, this proves nothing yogic. The scientists conduct their own experiments, and it is they who should interpret these experiments. But it's only worth to read it to show that the yoga analysis is not ridiculous in modern terms. On the contrary, it's seriously considered by physicists today, especially since 1982. The world has a phenomenal reality which is not the deep reality. And in the same way, the name and form appear to us, and they are based on something which is much deeper. Now, the yoga has its own experiment. It is not a philosophy that depends on the experiments of mental operation and material operation, and then says, yes, and furthermore. But the yoga has its own experiments directly on consciousness. But the only purpose of showing occasionally these things is to show that there is not necessarily this conflict. But the main point of the yoga experiments is that they find intelligence and reality behind the illusory, changing, and apparently meaningless phenomena of the world. They find purpose and intelligence. Now, the play is an example which is given by Shankara and was given very much by our teacher, that the world is like a play. When we go to a play, we see a world which has its own history. When we go to Hamlet, we see an ancient castle which must have been built centuries ago. It has its own history. It's odd that some of the characters have Roman names, like Horatio, but the Romans never got to Denmark. Polonius, he's from Poland. The Roman thought. The Latin form. But, yes, some of the North European chiefs took wives, Roman wives, who to a large extent civilized them. So Roman names would have come. And in that way, the play produces its own history as we analyze it. And when we look at plays, we see that characters mostly have a mania for autobiography at the beginning, which tells us the story so far. In The Tempest, Prospero says, must I again recite how I saved you from... And well, from the audience, we think, well, you must, if the audience are going to know what's happened so far. And in that way, a history is produced, and the play is complete. It has its own laws, which are not self-contradictory. In The Midsummer Night's Dream, Puck and Fly. They are Indian divinities, so it's the point it's not generally made in production, but Titania and Oberon are Indian divinities. They can fly. That's one of the laws of the play. One of the laws of the play is the herb, love in idleness, which produces this, put into the eyes, it produces love at first sight, first thing that's seen. That is a law, and it works. But it's the law within the play, within the scenario of the play. And we don't think, oh, how ridiculous. If we go to Julius Caesar, now people can't fly. Flying would be ridiculous But they were ghosts. These were ghosts. There are no ghosts in Midsummer Night's Dream. So the play is complete in its own scenario, with its own laws. And we can see that the dramatist sets the play and sets the laws, and looked at from another point of view, they are contradictory. But in their own right, they stand, and they're not contradictory. Now, our teacher used to stress this point, that the Maya, the Lord, the illusion, has an intelligent purpose, and that purpose is to reveal the Lord not only externally controlling the world, but internally as presiding over the operation of the heart. And the yoga training is to discover the Lord not only externally, but internally. And specific and definite and clear experiments are given. It's not a question simply of guesses or inferences or ideas or hopes or beliefs. There is an intelligence, says, behind the operations of the universe. Materialism doesn't think so. But materialism is based, as Eddington pointed out, a great scientist, pointed out, on selecting certain things to notice, on abstracting. It seems to be objective, but in actual fact it's only objective because it has ruled out so much of the universe. And Einstein pointed out that a good deal of science is rather like accountancy. Whether you're making cheeses or blast furnaces, they become figures. They figure in the profit and loss account. An accountant can run a steel mill without ever going near the place. He can simply run it on figures, noticing trends. And it seems that he's objective and abstract. But in actual fact, he's only objective because he never sees the place. He just sees these abstractions. And our teacher said that the test, one of the great experiments, and the test of the intelligence behind the universe consists in inspiration. This is one of the manifestations, not the only manifestation. It's an inspiration. And he used to point out how many of the central discoveries of science are produced not by logical invention of hypotheses to account for facts that can't yet be explained. They come about in an extraordinary way, not chance, but in a strange way. But there is a resistance to this idea, especially among scientists who like to think that they're specially logical and materialistic. It's the famous remark, which our teacher used to quote, that the idea of solving the world riddle by simply mental concepts and material experiments is like looking in a dark room for a black cat which is not there.